Ready to roll? Okay, good. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much indeed for coming on. Well done for getting tickets. I understand this is a sellout event, so yes, well done for getting in. And we're in the McCrum Lecture Theatre, and the event is violent nature. So thank you very much for coming. I think it's going to be a very interesting discussion. My name's James Randerson. I'm the Environment and Science News Editor at The Guardian. And we've got a fabulous panel here tonight. I'm going to introduce them a little bit later on, but I just wanted to say a few words about the sort of topics we're going to touch on. I think it's a really appropriate week, really, to be talking about some of these issues with the earthquake in southeastern Turkey that, I mean, it's a bit unclear at the moment the exact position, but maybe up to 1,000 dead. And one of our speakers here has... this very day, I think, been looking at what exactly how that earthquake happened and exactly what happened, the sort of seismology of it. So you may be interested to ask a little bit about that. I also wanted to say a little bit about another earthquake that happened in 2009 on the 6th of April. That was the L'Aquila earthquake in Italy. 309 people were killed and something like 17,000 were made homeless. Silvio Berlusconi, in his typically statesmanlike fashion, suggested that they should perhaps treat it as a camping weekend. But anyway, apart from the immediate aftermath, which was obviously very serious, and the efforts at reconstruction, there has been an ongoing story there, which is a group of six seismologists and a government official who are currently being prosecuted for manslaughter because ahead of the earthquake, they... made some statements about the likelihood of it happening because there had been some foreshocks, and they were trying to reassure people that just because there are foreshocks, it doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be a big earthquake. And as a result of them expressing their sort of expert opinion, they're now in the dock being accused of manslaughter, which I think, you know, neatly ties together some of the issues of the science and the sort of public policy and. Probably, I think, for seismologists, quite a scary precedent, particularly if they're convicted. So maybe we'll touch on a little bit of that. Before I move on, I just want to say a little bit about our sponsor this evening, which is the Research Council UK's Global Uncertainties Programme. The Research Councils, of course, are the public funders of science, or one of the major public funders of science in the UK. And the Global Uncertainties Programme brings together the activities of these research councils in response to global security challenges, helping governments, businesses, societies to better predict, detect, prevent and mitigate threats to security. And it's all really about getting academics who might otherwise be operating in silos to work together and to share knowledge and expertise in order to hopefully the sum be greater than the sum of the parts. Current work is partly about the sort of events that we might touch on, like earthquakes and tsunamis and things like that, but also things like terrorism and ideologies and belief systems, transnational organised crime, cyber security, threats to infrastructures, and the development of weapons of mass destruction. So pretty serious stuff. If you want to know more about that, you can go to www.globaluncertainties.org.uk. So, the way things are going to work this evening, I'll introduce our panel in a second, just in case you weren't worried, they are sitting down there, they're not, they are here. we're going to hear from each of them for about 10 minutes first, and then very much I'd like it to be a discussion led by you in the audience, so please think of questions and comments and things that you'd like to say. A few housekeeping points. Please turn off your mobile phones, and we're not expecting a fire alarm, so if something like that happens, watch out for a member of staff who will lead you safely out into the open air, we hope. And if you'd like to discuss this on Twitter, and you can get a signal inside this concrete bunker, then you can use the hashtag, if you like, #CFI for Cambridge Festival Ideas 2011. So let me introduce our excellent speakers. First of all, we'll be hearing from Professor James Jackson, who is Professor of Active Tectonics and Head of the Department of Earth Sciences here at the University of Cambridge. You may recognise him if you've got a long memory from 1995 when he delivered the Royal Institution Christmas Lectures back when they were on the BBC, and they were entitled Planet Earth, an Explorer's Guide. He's also a Fellow of the Royal Society. Second up, we'll have Professor John Preston, who his research is part of the Global Uncertainties Programme. He's a Professor of Education at the University of East London, and some of his research is into how to use social media, for example, Twitter and Facebook, to help during evacuations. And I think he will be touching on some of that and other things. Third up, we've got Andrew Collins, who is a reader in Disaster and Development and director of the Disaster and Development Centre at Northumbria University. Some of his research has also been part of the Global Uncertainties Programme. And lastly, we have Daniel Walden, who's policy advisor for disaster risk reduction at Save the Children. So without further ado, Professor Jackson, if you'd like to kick off. Thanks very much.
Thanks. I'm just going to make a few points about the world we live in now, really just for the sake of the panel discussion later. I'm a seismologist. I spent today looking at the Turkish earthquake, in fact, looking at the seismograms of that to work out what happened in that Turkish earthquake, and I'll explain later why we do that kind of thing. Let me just show you a couple of slides to make the point here. Here we're looking at two pictures of two earthquakes in 2010. Both these earthquakes affected big conurbations of about 1 million people. This is Port-au-Prince in Haiti. In the top right there is the Concepcion in Chile. These earthquakes were very different in size. So if we look at them, they both affected populations about 1 million people. The Haiti one was about 400 times smaller than the earthquake in Chile. The earthquake in Chile was really big. It was about the sixth or seventh biggest earthquake of the last 100 years. And if you look at the deaths there, the Chile earthquake killed 560, most of whom died in a tsunami, which is a rather different story. The Haiti earthquake killed close to 250,000. So there's obviously a story here. This is an interesting thing. Why the much smaller earthquake killed many more people in Haiti. That was 2010. 2011, of course, brought a couple of earthquakes in the news. One is the Japan earthquake here, Tohoku earthquake here, which, of course, has been in the news a lot, mostly because of the damage to the tsunami and the nuclear power station. But this needs to be put into perspective. This was the third largest earthquake of the last 100 years. It was absolutely huge. It moved a fault. Earthquakes happen when faults bust. It moved a fault the length from here to Inverness, the width from here to Bristol, and twice the length of this room. That moves an awful lot of rock around. Right? That moves so much rock around, it alters the orbits of satellites. You have to recalibrate the satellite orbits afterwards because they change as a result of such a thing. In this earthquake, something like 30 million people were exposed in Tokyo. 6 million were exposed to shaking of 8. 8 is when your house starts to fall down in most places. And 25,000 died, nearly all of them in the tsunami, in fact. And the tsunami is a slightly different story. So this is an astonishingly small death toll, 0.4%. Had it not been for the tsunami, the number of deaths would have been very, very small. The triumph of this earthquake was that of 35 million people in Tokyo, 3 died. Last time in Tokyo, a big earthquake in 1923 killed 150,000 people. So this would have been a triumph of Japanese earthquake engineering had it not been for the tsunami, which is a slightly different story. And then finally, I want to draw your attention to these two earthquakes, which are exactly the same size, the one in Christchurch in New Zealand earlier this year in February, and the earthquake in Bam in 2003 in Iran. These were precisely the same size. They affected cities slightly different in size. Christchurch, 350,000 odd, and Bam, 120,000. Bam was almost exactly the same size as Cambridge at that time, and the same population, same area. And look at the deaths. Bam, 30,000 people were killed outright. That's 25% of the population. Christchurch, 166, mostly in a single building, a television building which fell down. So look at the percentage of the population here. So the world is splitting into quite different experiences. Places like New Zealand, Japan, Chile will not and do not have the experiences of places like Iran, Pakistan, China, Turkey, parts of Turkey, and Central Asia. So in one of these stories is essentially a story about money, and the other is a story about killing people in huge numbers. Let me just follow that up with this picture here, which shows along this bottom line axis here the number of deaths in the earthquake, and this is in factors of 10, from 100 here up to 100,000 there. And this is the cost of the earthquake in terms of money. And here are various earthquakes plotted on here. Let me just draw your attention to a couple. This is one in the suburbs of Los Angeles in 1994 in Northridge. It's near San Fernando. And it's the most expensive earthquake when it happened of its time. And it costs a huge number of dollars here, $30 billion, I think it cost. But that is less than 1% of California's GDP. It was a blip in the economy of California. Almost the same cost was this earthquake in Haiti here, 2010, here, which was more than 100% of Haiti's GDP. So the problem with a poor country like Haiti is not only do a vast number of people die, 34 people died in this earthquake here in the suburb of Los Angeles, and this earthquake here in Haiti called Port Dominion. But this wipes out the entire economy of a country. So this is like a game of snakes and ladders, where you've got a snake which takes you all the way back to the beginning, and you have to start again. There's no resilience built in with that kind of experience here. So this is what is behind the way seismologists now sum this up, which is the rich pay and the poor die. That's what earthquakes are about now in the world. And of course, it's about slightly more than that, because it's not earthquakes which kill people. The quote, of course, is that buildings kill people, not earthquakes. And so this is inevitably related then to the quality of the buildings, and the building industry is notoriously the most corrupt industry on the planet. Right? So the problem is not just building codes, but making sure they're enforced and that people don't make shortcuts and so on and so on and so on. So the world we live in at the moment is one where earthquakes target the most vulnerable people. There are people in places like Haiti. It's one thing to say they don't have building codes and they're corrupt and they don't monitor the building codes. But when you get to a country like Haiti, the problems of corruption and poverty and ignorance are just mixed up. It's hard to really separate separate the effects of all these things together. The problem with all those things together is that they involve now huge numbers of people living in these megacities in crummy buildings. So in the next 10 years, something like 1 to 3 billion new buildings will be built in these countries which are extremely vulnerable to earthquakes, in cities which have been destroyed before, but cities which only had modest populations before. So many of the cities in Central Asia, the capital cities of Iran, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, have been destroyed in the last 100 years, and they killed only a few thousand people. But now their cities, all of them, well over a million people. And as you can see, in those cities, you get death rates of 30, 40% routinely. Okay? So that's what we're up against at the moment. So this is really just to provoke some discussion. Later we'll talk more about this, I'm sure. Is there anything we can do? Is there a fix? The only long-term fix to this is actually education. Once people start saying in places like Iran, how come this earthquake in the suburb of Los Angeles kills 34 people and in my town it kills 30,000 people? I want to be like them. And say to politicians, I want to be like them. You don't have to die in earthquakes of that size anymore on the planet. We want to be in that position, not in the position we're in. Education is, in the end, the only way, really, to break this cycle here and go from one sort of experience to the other. At least that's what I think. And that's also what we do in this university. It's one of the things we know how to do, is to take people from these countries and educate them so they do actually become part of the global community which knows how to deal with these things. And that's why I spent today doing what I did. In the end, you need to find out what happens in these earthquakes to learn from them. In a very, very simple way, you can do the thought experiment. Even the biggest earthquakes like Japan, they just move the rocks a few meters. If you know how they moved it, you can do a thought experiment. You can say, okay, supposing that earthquake repeats 100 times, and we have not just a few meters, but hundreds of meters. Oh, look, I can see how the landscape is formed around me. I can read the signals in the landscape which tell me what's going on. I know how to prepare. So that's actually why people don't die anymore in California, Japan, and New Zealand. It's not because we can forecast the earthquakes. We cannot predict them, not in any of those countries. The reason people don't die in those countries is because the buildings don't fall down. And the reason the buildings don't fall down is because there's a link between the scientists, the builders, the architects, the town planners, and most important, the legislators who make sure that those building regulations are followed. Right? So that is the chain, that is the link between science and making a difference here. We have fantastic facilities and ability now to
see in immense detail what's going on, not just the sound waves, which is what I spent today looking at, but we have GPS, we have radar satellites up there looking at precisely what happened in those earthquakes. And within a day or two of each earthquake, we know pretty nearly exactly what happened. Within a week, we do know exactly what happens. We sometimes have to wait for a satellite to come over a second time. Right? But the question is how you learn from that experience. So it is important to do the forensic work afterwards. It's not shutting the barn door after the horse has gone. It's actually learning from what happened to help you next time. And I'm going to stop now. I'm sure there's plenty to talk about.
Right, so my name is John Preston. I'm Professor of Education at the University of East London. My interest in disasters is I'm interested in disaster education. So how people learn to prepare for disasters. So there's various different ways they do it. They do it through public information. They do it through community groups. They do it through looking at what other people do in other countries. And actually look at disasters as learning events that people learn while a disaster's in process. And what I want to do is I'm going to talk a bit about social media, but I want to put it in a bit of historical context and look at a bit of some of the history of disaster education in the UK. 40 years ago, the UK government was looking to prepare British citizens for the event of nuclear war. And it developed a campaign called Protect and Survive, which involved television, involved a booklet, involved newspaper inserts. It was never released en masse, but later there was demand for the public to release it and see what it looked like. And some of my research recently has been to interview the policymakers and the creatives who actually made Protect and Survive and see what they actually thought about the process. And Protect and Survive as a booklet basically just says you've got to just follow the advice that the British government give you. You've got to stay in your home, you've got to build a shelter, you've got to be prepared to stay there for 14 days without coming out, and you've got to have a good supply of food, and you've got to have a radio with batteries so you can listen to further updates. Now, people often say, well, this was ludicrous advice, this didn't work, it wouldn't work. Well, actually, the civil servants and the Home Office scientists we've interviewed did actually agonise about this, and they knew it would not save the population en masse. They knew it was kind of a trade-off. They knew it would save some people, but not others. And it actually meant that the people who survived would live in suburban or rural areas. They'd live in detached houses. They'd be able to shelter in their own homes. It even assumed that there was kind of a traditional nuclear family with the dad building the shelter, the mum getting the food supplies ready, and the kids getting the colouring books ready to shelter in place. But if you lived in the city centre, if you lived in flats or bungalows or caravans, if you were part of an extended family without the resources to shelter in place, things would be more difficult. So Protect and Survive actually made two assumptions. First of all, it assumed that people would just follow the advice of the state. And secondly, it assumed that there was going to be some inequity in a disaster. And actually, this still carries on. So some of you will have got through your doors in 2004 a booklet called Preparing for Emergencies, which is about a kind of unspecified attack. It might be terrorism, it might be a natural disaster. But again, the advice is go in, stay in, tune in, have food supplies ready, have a bag ready to actually stay in place. Now, two things have changed since Protect and Survive and since preparing for emergencies, I think. First of all, people no longer really trust the government or the state as much as they did. So there isn't as much trust in official communications. Secondly, there's been a huge increase in mobile communications, in social media, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, so people can actually communicate with each other and through mobile technologies as well. So Twitter is thought to be kind of a panacea for disasters, and I want to partly agree with that and partly give you pour a bit of cold water on that. So why is social media thought to be so positive? Well, it allows you to search in real time for what's actually happening in an event, allows you to look at sentiment, how people are feeling about an event, allows for real-time monitoring and prediction of things like pandemics and other crises. But it can also lead to rumours. So in January 2010, a Twitter rumour caused the evacuation of Grand Central Station in New York. So it's not always positive. You know, people say, well, it's always about rumour spreading. But social media does change the dynamics of disaster response, and I'm currently working on a project with other colleagues at other universities about the dynamics of evacuations and how that changes. And I want to share with you just four points concerning social media and evacuations. First of all, we've been farming tweets, okay, over the last year. We've been farming tweets from around the world and looking at how social media use changes over time in a crisis and in a disaster and in an evacuation. And we think that tweets go through three stages. First of all, there's kind of an information seeking and sharing stage. So people are tweeting saying, you know, something's happened here, what's happening here, they're sharing and seeking information. Secondly, there's an emotional engagement stage. So people say, what does this mean? Or this is very sad, or what are the consequences of this? And the third stage is people start to project opinions. This shouldn't have happened. Why did this happen here at this point? And the whole loop can take as quick as 4 hours for this to happen. And so what we think is that it requires different responses at different times. So in the emotional engagement stage, for example, people are very receptive to hearing information and getting direction. And sentiment can change negative if they're not getting information from aid agencies at that time. Secondly, one of our findings is about message propagation and connection. So we've run a simulation on Facebook, and the simulation is that imagine that the government have said, you must shelter in place. There's been a natural disaster or a terrorist attack. You must stay in your home at this time. And that there's a rumour spreading, a malicious rumour saying, don't listen to the government. What we've found in terms of simulating, looking at other rumour spreading, if it's 10 random people out of Facebook network of 800 people, if it's 10 people at random, the rumour will only spread 42% of the time. But if it's the 10 most connected people, the rumour will spread 100% of the time. So it's very important in an emergency situation in terms of social media to get those people who are most connected on board. The third finding is about local conditions, about people being pre-prepared. And we've looked at the social media strategies of London, Birmingham, Carlisle. If you want an example of a good social media strategy, look at the Birmingham website, because they're very prepared in terms of social media. What we'd also say is it's important to pre-prepare people in terms of social media. So it's no use just sending a message saying, hello, this is the fire service, and now we're tweeting, because people just won't believe it. And a good example of that is, in terms of pre-preparation, is the CDC, the Center for Disease Control in America. No one looks at their news releases. No one really looks at their website unless there's an outbreak or something's happening. So someone from CDC put up an announcement saying, would you be prepared for a zombie invasion? Have you got your grab bag ready? Have you got your resources ready? And actually got more people to look at the CDC website than anything else they'd ever put up there. So you've got to use social media cleverly. You've got to use viral marketing techniques. You've got to be clever about it and creative about it, because it's a very creative medium. And the fourth thing we'd say about it is self-organisation is very important in terms of social media. And we've actually shown, if you look at the website for the project, that the efficiency of building evacuations, if you have social media, if you have connection, it actually increases the rate at which buildings are actually evacuated. So social media does have some promise. So what's the change between Protect and Survive and where we are now? Well, obviously there's a technology change. You know, there's a possibility of self-organisation. People don't necessarily listen to the state. But I think the similarity is in terms of equity and inequity. We can't assume that everyone's got access to social media, and we can't assume that everyone will use it the same way. Okay, thanks.
Hello, evening. And now to add a few more thoughts and ideas to the evening. I've called this Violent Nature and the Impact of Development, and I basically work at the Disaster and Development Centre at Northumbria University, and we basically focus on all things to do with the links between disasters and development. I suppose really the rationale behind this is that perhaps no disasters are actually natural. They're all about being in the wrong place at the wrong time without adequate forms of protection. This is underlining the development approach. So I'll take you through, I think a number of points may have been touched upon already, but these are my key points tonight. Development, to a large extent, determines the way hazards impact on people. Sustainable development offsets disaster, and major opportunities for disaster reduction. There are major opportunities because of this linkage. That's where the opportunities lie. It's not inevitable that large numbers of people will be caught up in major disasters. These are avoidable. Now, I won't take you longer than a few seconds on the data, but I think some of the points about this type of data were made in the first presentation. But perhaps there's just a couple of things to look at. And the key point here is you've got high development countries, you've got medium development countries, low development countries, according to Human Development Index. So that's if you look at things like education, health, and to a certain extent nutrition, even income. So these indices are what the United Nations use to define what type of country you live in. And I suppose the key points from this, that if you take any section of dates, these happen to be the period 94 to 2003, but you'll find exactly the same pattern if you take the period at present period. You'll find that you've got the low Human Development Index countries is where you're going to have the highest rates of mortality. So deaths from disasters are highest. The key thing to remember is what I've highlighted here. Population varies immensely between different regions. Second point is that if you're in a medium development country, so perhaps a lot of the Asian countries fall into this category, but where there are a lot of environmental hazards, tsunamis, earthquakes, cyclones, then the impact is the highest figure you'll find is there for the number of people affected by disasters, which is quite different to mortality. I suppose the third point to notice is a financial one again, but this time looking at the actual damage of the disasters, and the highest figures, as you'll see, come in the high development countries. Now, the reason for flagging that is it means that people view disasters in completely different ways in different parts of the world. In some cases, it's the risk of loss of life, whereas in other cases, an impact on the economy and on has a financial impact. This is quite relevant when we look at such an uneven world. Now, that's using that sort of data is really very broad, Pat, and it doesn't go into the detail. It's far more complex than that. And although we can use that as a backdrop to our story, I think if we're going to say, how are we going to deal with disasters? How are we going to respond and react? We really need to be looking at least these three things, individual behavior of people, and how people choose to look after the environment or not, look after society, look after economies. So there's a sort of human agency, personal choice element involved in this equation. We know the knowledge and the technology is critical, and we've made a lot of advances, but we've got a lot further to go. So we're getting a little better at knowing where a disaster is likely to happen and when, based on our science and technology. But we have huge gaps in knowledge still to conquer. And then there's the political will is the other aspect. How much money gets put into prevention of disasters, or does it all just go to responding to disasters once they've happened? Humanitarian assistance is a big budget. It's a necessary one. But wouldn't it be a bit cheaper if we invested a lot more time on something called disaster risk reduction, preventing disasters? And certainly, education is key to this, understanding this linkage. So DRR and development is a complex thing, and I give you one more of these diagrams, and I promise there's not very many to absorb, But this one makes quite an important point, that on the one hand, we're dealing with trying to get the knowledge right and be able to predict and understand disasters, the hazards, when an earthquake will happen, when a tsunami will happen, and where, who will be affected. And there's a great deal of uncertainty in that business. And we can choose to invest in managing the uncertainty. The alternative is to say, well, look, actually, disasters are not entirely natural. It's only because people are vulnerable to them. If we make people resilient, if we address vulnerability, we can make those sorts of choices. This is why the field is political, why it is about science, and why it is about people. It involves a lot of decision-making. And the conundrum is something to do with being able to get from this unstable threat we have down in the left-hand corner there, where we don't have the knowledge, so we're not able to predict. The predictability is low, and the ability to be able to control it is also low. How do we get up to that more stable situation in the top right-hand corner there? And these are like the pathways that one might choose to do that. You could go more for creating resilience, that's making people strong, defending people, or you might go for getting more of the detailed information which is required. Well, perhaps the middle road is the sensible sort of way where we can strive for both of those things. But we will, if we're going to do that, we're probably going to have to accept that we never know, we'll know all of the risks which there are for the next disaster. But we can at least be reducing vulnerability as we go. And that's all about development. So what sort of knowledge is required for this? Well, the answer to that is a whole mixture of different knowledges. We need hard science, we need soft science, however you define those. But it involves different cultures, different perspectives, different behaviours. And, you know, the arts and faith come into this because that is how people understand their world and interpret and behave in their world. So all of those sources of knowledge are important. And these are merely some pictures just from my own sort of... it's a little bit like day in the life, because in this field, when we're talking about disaster management, then you are sometimes dealing with people in uniforms who are responding and doing a wonderful job doing that. Other times you're working perhaps with scientists who are trying to measure data to be able to understand where the next type of event will happen and how. And other times it's about listening to people and understanding people. This one is just about using a people-centered approach to doing your risk reduction and development. Well, it's by way of an example, really, of an aspect of our field is early warning to prevent a disaster. And I suppose the key point I really want to make with this is and development. So this box down the left-hand side here says that it starts with improving well-being and motivating people. That's the key point. If you can do that, then people will be engaged in reducing the risks of disasters. So we move along. The knowledge improves the capacity and the resilience, the strength of people to engage with doing something about this increases. And we get then a more effective system. I think we've done a lot of this sort of thing in the past, but the bit that's been missing is the motivation and the inclusion of a very wide, broad community of people. Community-based programs are basically one of the key ways forward in this sort of work, involve people, and this is just the type of sort of structure we would use now for a community-based disaster risk reduction type of project. So this is people basically taking the situation into their own hands and saying, let's manage those risks. So how do we stimulate any community here in the UK, Bangladesh, Mozambique, or wherever we are looking at changing environments? How do we stimulate people to be engaged in the process? Are they going to wait for the scientists? Are they going to wait for the politicians? Well, no, I would argue this is for everybody, and we can do that at a local level. You can form local committees, and you can have, therefore, people taking control of the information for themselves. What's a risk to one person is not a risk to somebody else. There's huge differences. Some people are more risky than others. So it's if we start with the community, we can do quite a lot in this work. However, we mustn't neglect the other aspects. We need that information. We need the technology. We need the current information. So as you can see, there's some other linkages here. Technical support. We've just heard about communication is particularly critical. So that's just an example. I've seen this sort of thing work quite well in cities in Mozambique and rural areas of Nepal. And in Bangladesh and those sorts of contexts. Thank you.
Unless you were on your way.
You never know how much more there is.
Evening. You'd be forgiven for thinking, since I'm the disaster risk reduction policy advisor at Save the Children, that you're going to get exactly the same thing again. And you kind of are, but from a slightly different perspective. So let's see how we get on. I was sent three kind of broad questions to think about, so I thought I'd just address them straight off. First one being, what is the role of aid agencies in dealing with natural disasters? I haven't been in a university for quite some time, so I thought I'd start by questioning the question and just thinking about what dealing with actually means. Now, I expect I'm here to be talking about the humanitarian response side of things, but being the DRR guy, I also want to talk about the prevention, the mitigation, the recovery process, the transition to development and then sustainable development for disaster risk reduction so that the response doesn't have to happen. All of these things are part of the role of aid agencies in dealing with natural disasters. The other thing was, are disasters natural? We heard that a second ago, is it a hazard that's natural and a disaster that's affecting people who aren't sufficiently prepared or sufficiently resilient to cope with it and come out the other side on top? All questions to think about for later. Aid agencies' reason for being tends to be ensuring the survival and well-being of the people that they work with, specifically children in the case of Save the Children, Women for Oxfam, and so on and so forth. Different roles will be different depending on the context. So if there's an emergency and search and rescue is needed, shelter, supplies, food and water, health and sanitation services, or a combination of all of these things, the whole lot in a big disaster such as in Haiti, it'll change according to what we're needed to do. All towards the ultimate objective of keeping people's survival up and their well-being healthy. And it'll generally tend to be in a place where governments lack capacity or the will to protect the citizens for themselves without having to ask for external help. Part of what we do, I suppose, in our role is working within the international system and supporting the international system, channeling different donors' funds. So, for example, the British government wants to donate to an emergency, they can send it through aid agencies they trust, so that then they know that they're going to get reporting back, good reporting that they know we are trained on, and so they know what their money's being spent on. Simple as that. But yeah, it's not just the aid system, it's about response, recovery, reconstruction, transition to development, prevention, preparedness. I would maybe rather have asked the question, what would I like our role to be? And that would be certainly much more on the prevention and preparedness side of things than response. Same as everyone, I think. Next question was, how can areas make themselves better prepared? On this front, areas, I would say, we need to think about, partly because, are we talking about geographical area? Are we talking about countries? Are we talking about districts, local areas? We can look at the last presentation, thinking about the risk and resilience building, risk reduction, resilience building. And that would be a part of making themselves better prepared, thinking about whether they're going to get up as a community and go, right, what can we do, or whether their local government or their national government are going to support them or encourage them to be better prepared. Thinking about geographical boundaries, the areas and the preparedness kind of come together in that you've got East Africa at the moment, for example, the Mekong Delta, where a lot of people across borders have the same kind of risks, but because there are borders there, they're not as coordinated and not as such as prepared as they might be for one emergency. We saw just now 3 points for risk reduction, resilience building, which were political will, knowledge and technology, and then individual behaviour. I had political will, investment and stakeholder engagement, which are very close to the same thing, I think. Thinking about political will, you've got leadership, set an example. You need governments, local governments, national governments, international agreements to set an example. You need them to support initiatives from nothing, from kind of an idea that's a good idea. Give it a go, pilot it, and support it. A lot of the time in China, for example, a lot of our work is piloting on behalf of the government because the government doesn't want to do something and do it wrong, essentially. So say the children does the piloting, and then the Chinese government will go, brilliant, let's do that. And then because it's China, it gets done, and it's amazing when it does. But it depends on the context according to how much support you get and how much uptake there is in the first place. And then you've got coordination. You've got support for not just a whole new project from nothing, but you've got identification of a good project and support for that project to get bigger, to scale up, and then to scale out, to replicate into other communities, other countries even, on the coordination front. So on the political will front, I think you've got to think about policy, the commitment, standing on a stage saying, yep, that's great. You've got to have the planning that's as a result of that, and then once you've got the plan, you need it to be implemented, and that's where Save the Children and all of our friends in the NGO networks are shouting at the moment. You need action at the local level, not just kind of a piece of paper in a ministry somewhere. Investment. Who invests? Governments, donors, people, everyday Joe, NGOs, and local authorities. So how? Governments and donors, they need money, they need time, and they need expertise. All of these kind of different things that were, it's not just about money. A lot of the time, for example, maybe I should say this is my opinion at the moment, not the opinion of Save the Children, but maybe in East Africa at the moment, there's money flying at it. It's how to spend it and what else to invest in with it. It's not just about the money. So when you're talking about investment, you're thinking about the expertise. You need to build people's capacity and knowledge. You need to think about the time, investing time into communities, into people, into education. In Save the Children and in Oxfam, all the NGO usual suspects, you've got investment in ourselves. We've got a whole big capacity building department, which is based on preparedness. We've got 85, I think, offices around the world, all of which have to have a preparedness plan. So we're investing in our own preparedness to then go and respond on the occasion that our ongoing development work wasn't ready for a particular emergency.
30 seconds.
That's right. Crikey. Okay, I'll run through it. And what to invest in. Okay, so I've said you've got money, you've got stuff. You've got equipment, you've got tools, you've got stocks, like pre-positioned stocks, food, water, that kind of thing. But then you've got software, the knowledge, the awareness, all of that kind of stuff. I'm going to start racing now. And one big strong tool in this investment, I would say, is the hazard vulnerability capacity assessment, which is basically a risk assessment, which we do with communities. And that's the stakeholder engagement. And one of the big things that we talk about, I think, in Save the Children and across the NGO community is that it shouldn't just be us who's doing the stakeholder engagement. And ask me a question about that later because I'm going to jump on. What is the state of the nations across the world in terms of ability to respond? Varied, and the pressure is on. I'll go into this from the seats slightly more, but basically it's very difficult to go Africa, not so good, Latin America, pretty good, Asia, somewhere in the middle. Countries are different, hazards are different, risks are different. There's different kinds of approaches to making that decision. A development person might say that people who are still stuck in a kind of chronic poverty situation can't come out the other side. Whereas a humanitarian person might say, you need a delivery platform for response stuff. And we can talk about that more in a minute as well. Okay, so just while I've got this up, everyone should go to this website. Remember it later. To read about the Children's Charter for Disaster Risk Reduction. And if you want to know more about that, I can talk to you about it later on, because we ask children around the world what their preparedness priorities are, and we got five, and they're on that. Okay.
Fantastic. Thank you very much indeed. So, gentlemen, if you'd like to take a seat up here, we'll, share one microphone on the panel up here, and I will... please, if you have a question, put your hand up and I will send the microphone, or my colleague will come your way with the microphone. So please wait until you get it before you ask your question. And we'll sort of take it from there. Yeah, so who's... I guess I sort of took from that pretty much everyone was agreeing that prevention and preparation is much better and cheaper than cure, if you like. So maybe that's a theme that sort of comes out generally. I also took out of it that if I want lots of people to go to the Guardian's website, I should do more stories about zombies. But I might have to get my reporters onto that tomorrow. Who's got a question? Lady here.
If you could speak into the microphone, because we are recording this event. Thank you.
Thank you. I was wondering if you could comment on situations where a community is directly at risk, but in some cases they choose to be there. I believe there's an Italian settlement and the volcano nearby is becoming more active. The government has offered to assist and help them relocate, but they prefer to stay. There's also a community in Cape Verde that's actually within the crater of the active volcano. So what does one do when a community sees more benefits in staying than reducing risk and evacuating ahead of time?
Maybe one for maybe Andrew or... Daniel, will you? Please use the mic. I think it's on.
Yes, it's a key question. And interestingly, I was just a few days ago at the launch of a government report on global environmental migration. And one of the themes that have come out of this big, big study that's been going on for some years is that people are actually trapped. They can't migrate away. To migrate away from a hazard is a form of adapting to that hazard. You can move. Many people can't actually move away. And others are moving into more hazardous locations. Specific case of volcanoes and people living around them, I'm not so familiar with. But I would guess sometimes it's to do with the perception of the risk. In other cases, we know that it's not so much the perception, it's a source of livelihood that people are fixed to. And this is particularly, the most classic case of that would be floodplains, where people will stay on the floodplain because it's the rich, fertile soils, and that's where your livelihood is. And to move away is a form of impoverishment. You lose your livelihood. In case of craters or volcanoes, it's a little bit different, but it could be... You'd have to look at each individual case, but it's likely to be a combination of livelihoods and some perception factors. I think in Mount Merapi in Indonesia, there is a cultural reason why people will stay right on the side of the volcano. And I think in Mount Cameroon as well.
Daniel, do you want to pick that one up?
Just to add, I used to work at Plan International, and one of our projects there was with a community or a group of communities where it was in Indonesia, and there was a reason why they just wouldn't move away from the base of the volcano. And being a child-centered organization, what we did as a kind of a way of educating it, raising awareness and kind of building kind of contingency plans in the community was kind of with Muppet-style puppet shows. And we had this, it's on YouTube, you can see it, it's called Tales from Disasters, this little character. And you know when Muppets panic, they kind of look each way and then they kind of run off like that. It's amazing. We've got a selection of these puppet shows. One of them was for volcano safety. And it's just incredible. And the schools and communities use these. And when the children are learning about what to do, if anything should happen, then they can go, right, Mum and Dad, this is what we're going to do. And so that's just one example of what we did, I suppose.
Is this just an example of a sort of bigger point about sort of natural human nature, in the sense that I think it ties in with the problem that people are who are so very poor and are just kind of trying to scrape out a living. They just don't have the capacity to think ahead to, you know, building a very, or even the ability to build a very strong house that would survive an earthquake. And so, you know, it's more about the here and now. And I'm on a floodplain, and that's where my livelihood is, rather than, you know, trying to do something more complicated, more difficult.
I would say, yeah, there's kind of the two parts to it. It's kind of the forward thinking of, maybe I do want to build a stronger house in the future, but that's not going to happen for a few years yet. So in the meantime, we've got one strong building in the community. It's the school. And everyone knows that that's the strong building. It's the only one that's made from concrete or whatever. And it's got the appropriate kind of measures in place to make it survivable in an earthquake. And so it's a case of, this is what we've got. Let's work with it. And while the development programs are going on or whatever else in what we do, then we'll kind of move on and try and ensure that the resilience and the, once people start building their own houses out of concrete, whatever, then the kind of the bigger picture kind of becomes.
Let's see, move on to another question. This lady in the front.
Forgive my macaroni English, we come from Italy. Okay. I just wanted to answer the lady's question because we happen to be living on a volcano, which is probably on the picture just behind us, which is Mount Etna. And we are actually living on this volcano and staying on this volcano during the eruption, like you see there behind you. So we're not absolutely afraid of it. And if you know volcanoes a little bit, we can give you clear answers why people choose to stay and live around the volcanoes, right? So in the case of a volcano like Mount Etna, it's typically a fissile volcano. So it's probably safer to be living, seismically speaking, from a seismic point of view, and seismologists could confirm that. It's probably much safer to be living on the volcano than in any other part of Sicily. Because we do have very, very dangerous earthquakes in Sicily, but the earthquakes that we happen to have on Etna are, for instance, lesser than the ones we have in Catania or in Messina.
Is that true?
Yes, it's
true. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your comment. Any other questions? The lady there with the glasses. And incidentally, I should say that there will be a podcast of this event after it's finished, and I'm not sure how long it'll take to be ready, but I'll put it on my I'll put it on my Twitter feed, which is James_Randerson. Anyway, please tell me your question.
For Andrew, you mentioned about some successful community initiatives, and you mentioned Mozambique and Nepal as good examples. I wondered if you could tell us a bit more about what those community initiatives were, what people were doing, what that looked like.
I would refer to them as successful in that they've managed to survive over a period of time without imploding, and many development initiatives don't. I use the term in a relative sort of way, successful, and I'll major on the successes. And what they would do is, if it's a health-centered program, then the assessment of the risks tends to be about diarrheal diseases, for example, in the community, and the information is passed around, and then an action decision is taken. And it's taken on the basis of the population's own risk assessment. That's the whole point. So in the case of Beira in Mozambique, the community started cleaning up their Beira, their suburb, to such an extent that the cases of cholera actually did start to go down quite significantly. In the Nepalese cases, is an interesting case there. It accompanied the setting up of these risk committees, and our assumption was that people were bothered about landslides, earthquakes, and those sorts of things, which are big issues in Nepal. But quite interestingly, the community there decided that their main issue was pesticides in the crops and the food, which was causing very high rate of abnormalities amongst newborn children. So what they did was self-organize to a certain extent to be able to address that issue. I wouldn't like to say, you know, this caused a whole revolution that changed the pesticide situation in certain parts of Nepal, but certainly the seeds of people's awareness and taking action were sown there. And you know, we're carrying out studies to try and work out what is vital ingredient in that process to make it work. And I couldn't tell you precisely what that is, because I think it varies from place to place, from group to group. But very often a highly motivated individual person with a big vision is certainly one ingredient which seems to be required to make that happen.
Does anyone have a question on the sort of seismology side of things, or perhaps on the Twitter questionnaire? The young chap down the front there.
Question for the seismologist. It's about when will we be able to ever predict earthquakes, and how long will it take to develop the technology for that?
That's a very, very good question. It's the sort of question that, journalists ask geologists all the time, and they get quite annoyed by it.
There's no sign that we'll be able to predict them in the sense of saying it'll be next Wednesday at 9:30. Right? We are already pretty good at identifying places that are dangerous to live. And that is, in the end, what saves lives. And I think people now realize that among the scientific and the seismological community. The way to save lives is to make people build buildings which will stay up. And it doesn't actually matter that you can't tell when it's going to happen. And indeed, as the introducer said at the beginning, a number of my friends are on trial in Italy at the moment because people don't realise that in Italy. At least the prosecutor doesn't realise that. So some places like this last earthquake in Japan, the couple of recent earthquakes in California happened in places which had hundreds of instruments all over the place measuring every conceivable thing you can think of measuring, and none of the earthquakes were preceded by anything at all. What happened in this one in L'Aquila in Italy a couple of years ago, you referred to them as foreshocks. With hindsight, you know they're foreshocks. If there's a small earthquake and it's followed by a big earthquake, you say, oh, that was a foreshock. Otherwise, you say it was a small earthquake and nothing happened. Right? You cannot tell that a small earthquake is going to be followed by a big earthquake. In many countries like Italy, there are lots of small earthquakes every single day. And if you tried to evacuate towns every time there was one, then no one would ever want to be living in trees. So you can't do it. There's no sign you can do it. It's a big distraction. When the Americans put someone on the moon in 1969, it was famously after President Kennedy said, we will put someone on the moon in 10 years. And President Nixon said, we will solve earthquake prediction in 10 years. And in 10 years, the U.S. government poured billions of dollars into research on earthquake prediction. It got absolutely nowhere. All it did was create a bad name for science, because you could get funded to do absolutely anything you want, any crazy experiment, watching hamsters run up and down bits of wood, or seeing whether fish flocked at one end of a fish tank. Anything crazy idea you like would get funded, and it got nowhere at all, and it fizzled out. And actually, quietly, the engineers, the architects, the planners went about saving lives. And that's what's made the difference, and that's why people don't die anymore in California.
Did Nixon also start the war on cancer? Also,
it's a good question, because everyone asks that. And the man you'll all have heard of, Charles Richter, who invented the Richter magnitude scale, when he famously retired, there was a big send-off for him. And he launched into a great tirade for about an hour against earthquake prediction. He said, journalists go to earthquake prediction like hogs to the trough. That was his expression. Sorry. and it's a great distraction, and people should realise that to save lives, you don't need earthquake prediction.
The lady there in the check shirt.
Do you think then the risk assessment that they did in Japan of building the nuclear power stations in such an area of tectonic activity was a bit ridiculous?
There's a very interesting story about that. The earthquake was a huge earthquake, absolutely enormous earthquake, and the power plant was undamaged by the earthquake. It was not designed for an earthquake that size. It was designed to withstand an earthquake 10 times smaller, and it withstood the earthquake 10 times bigger. What destroyed the power plant was the power supply going off. So when there's a big earthquake of that sort, the power is automatically shut off to prevent fires, and that all happened. And then for things like which really matter, like power stations, there's a backup power supply which comes in. In the case of the power station, it was to cool the reactor. And you cool the reactor by pumping water through pipework, through coils, and that's quite vulnerable. And the thing people thought would fail were the pipework. They thought the pipework would bust, and that would be the cause of problems. But the pipework didn't bust. What bust was the power supply pumping water through the pipework. And it turns out, in retrospect, again, you can say it was a design error to build that power supply on the seaward side of the reactor and too low. They'd put all their faith in a war which was to keep the tsunami out. The war wasn't high enough. The tsunami's height was underestimated for reasons we only now are starting to understand. It's actually very difficult to estimate the height of the tsunami. The tsunami offshore in the Pacific Ocean was about a meter high. That's all it was, with a wavelength of 300 kilometers. On a flat, calm day in the middle of the ocean, you wouldn't notice it. Right? The problem is when it hits the beach and it gets shallower water, the water all piles up. And it's very, very difficult to get those calculations right, and they were wrong. For all sorts of reasons, which we only start, it simply illustrates that we don't understand those kinds of things as well as we thought we did. And yes, in retrospect, isn't it a shame they didn't build a power supply on a plinth 10 metres up higher? That would have been a better thing to do. And then there would have been no problem at all. But that power station really, I think, hid the triumph of the engineering, that almost everything stood up in the earthquake. A huge earthquake, much bigger than anyone thought. The other thing we got wrong was the size of the earthquake. Right? No one thought it would be that big. And almost everything stood up. So it was a triumph for the engineers in every respect, except that one detail of the planning of where the backup power supply is.
I'd like to bring John Preston into the discussion. So if anyone's got any questions about evacuation or use of social media, there's a lady over there in that corner. So I'm keeping you very fit there. I should probably have chosen somewhere close. Yeah.
I'm interested to hear Birmingham social media preparedness plan held up as a beacon of good practice. In your experience, given in societies where social media...
Some people may not know so much about it. Perhaps you could say a little bit more about that specific thing.
I was just, it was mentioned that Birmingham City was a good example. Oh, right. So in societies where social media is widely used, what is your general experience of the level of preparedness of the authorities to tackle the kind of misinformation and rumours that could be spread by social media in the event of a disaster?
Some places want to pretend it doesn't exist. And I think we saw in the riots that, you know, the government's default response is, how do we turn this thing off? How do we get rid of it? What can we do? We don't really like it and we don't want to have it. And certainly when you look at London, although people in London tell me it's changing, if you look at the London preparedness stuff for the general public, it doesn't mention social media. It talks about following instructions, following official advice, and it doesn't really assume. The London evacuation plan just assumes people are just going to follow the government, the mayor's advice, and just follow that plan. It's tricky evacuating a city anyway the size of London as it is. Whereas in Birmingham, there's a city centre evacuation plan. You can see it on the website. All of the local businesses know about it, and local residents in the city centre. And they'll all be alerted by text message or social media as well. So there's a difference in terms of the level of response. Now, the difficulty is, I would say in London, actually there's more, well, demographically, there's more connection with social media, there's more use of social media than anywhere else. So there's the potential for some difficulties if you ever wanted to evacuate large parts of London, because people will start gaming, they'll start spreading rumours, spreading information, sharing information with people that they know through texts or through BlackBerry Messenger about the best routes to take, and that might scupper some elements of the London evacuation plan. So it's important for people to be, it's important for authorities to pretend to not, you know, that it exists, it's out there, you can't turn it off. There's many different ways people can communicate with each other, and that's it. So I'd say Birmingham is much better in that respect.
I was interested in what you said about the people who are nodes who have lots of connections are key to this. Is there any sign of the authorities trying to sort of cultivate those people so that when something really bad happens, they can get them on side?
No, not in this country, no. But FEMA are quite good at that. FEMA are quite good at championing people in the States, but not yet. I mean, even Birmingham, it's got some community responders, but it's not really doing that through social networks. It's not getting the most connected people actually on board, so not yet.
Okay. Any other questions? Gentleman in that corner there.
I have a question about the way that social media can help with building evacuation that you mentioned. Like, how can you qualify that? Because I've been evacuated in a fire situation from a building of 300 people, and not one of the people looked at their social media devices, and I doubt that if we were evacuated from here, anyone would look. So does it have to be on a scale of hundreds of, like, thousands of people inside a building, or how can you...
That's a good question. Obviously, if the building's on fire, an airplane's on fire, you know, people just go for the nearest exit and they don't look at their devices, they don't look at social media at all, and actually it might be counterproductive for people to do so. We fear, actually, that if one of the negative consequences of social media could be people keep checking Twitter or Facebook to say, is this really happening, and for corroboration of information, rather than actually acting on it. So that's actually a problem of social media in itself. So, but in a city evacuation, I mean, to evacuate London would take over a week, and even then you'd have evacuated kind of the central sections of London. It's a massive operation. So in those circumstances, people would use social media. You know, you'd have to evacuate it in stages, so there would be communication between people. But I'd say even in building evacuations, if you look at what happened in 9/11 and the pager data and the mobile phone data, people were communicating with each other, and there's good evidence that communication actually helped more people to survive because they knew, you know, to leave the building, they knew which exits to actually use. So if it's over a period of time, if it's over hours, then, yes, social media and mobile communications do come into their own. But if it's, you know, a flash evacuation, then just go for it. So, yeah.
Another question. Yeah, sure. Why not?
Just on the social media stuff, a lot of the stuff we talk about when we're talking about children's involvement in disaster risk reduction is the fact that they're such amazing communicators, and their ability to get in contact with each other is far greater than perhaps their parents. When you looked at inequity in a disaster situation, did you find any kind of inequity to do with the age and demographics of the people who were using the social media as kind of that would match the inequity from the past?
Yeah, younger people use Facebook more to communicate in disasters than Twitter, and also mobile communications more. So that would affect, you know, where you want to put your messages, really. So yes, but it would be different to different countries. I mean, I think you, Shahidi, you may have come across that, which is a platform to enable people to use text messaging and blogging in disasters. That's been quite good because it's actually quite a low-tech solution. It doesn't require people to have, you know, expensive computers. You can or smartphones. You can actually do it by text messages. So.
Okay. Oh, the lady just...
Thanks. A couple of things. Well, I've got the experts in the room. What is the deal on Katla? I just want to know. And also, it sounds like if you can get this great union between the seismologists and the architect designers, that really is the way forward, for getting disaster response, crisis response. But how far do you think the academic world is on that? Do you think there's still a long way to go, or do we think we're getting that now?
Who wants to take the question on Katla? And could you say a little bit about
in Iceland? Oh, I don't know. Yeah, well, it will go up. It's been up in the past. It usually goes up after that earlier one, Eyjafjallajökull, once went off a year ago. So we all watch that. But they don't go off usually without warning. It's like your central heating. There's creaking and groaning going on down there as all the magma comes to the surface. And lots of little earthquakes. So it's usually pretty clear something's going on. And actually, these days, we can watch them inflate anyway, because the whole ground just blows up like a balloon before they go. So there are various things you can do. They tend not to go off unexpectedly.
And what about this sweet spot when the engineers and the seismologists work together? I mean, it speaks very much to what
I
you were saying.
I don't want to give the impression that it's all hunky-dory and we know what to do, right? There are huge social issues, which you three on my right are much more qualified to talk about than I am, about actually turning the scientific knowledge into some sort of action. It's not at all straightforward. Right? It's more straightforward in countries which were a bit more sophisticated and well educated, but it goes wrong, as in you can see in Italy. I mean, it's not straightforward always. It's usually initiated by some particular event. The classic one in California was the Long Beach earthquake in 1933, I think, where an earthquake in the night destroyed a lot of school buildings which fell down made of brick. And that enabled the legislation to pass a law called the Field Act, which required a government building inspector to be resident on the building site 24 hours a day for any public building. And that actually, you know, it's a sort of brute force approach to making sure building regulations are followed, and it's still in place. And it sort of worked. So, so they've had 70 years without an earthquake of comparable size, with, you know, building inspectors resident on the building site 24 hours a day when something important like a school or a hospital is built. And sure, that increases resilience over time. But I don't think there's any easy way.
How do you go about doing that in countries, though, where they, you know, they perhaps, as you say, don't have the capacity, don't have the political will, or you know, there's corruption and so on? I mean, that seems to me the hardest part of this.
Yes. I think it's a case of, well, from our point of view, it's a case of getting kind of relatively close to the warmest ministry before we kind of start throwing in kind of radical ideas about kind of legislation and all this other stuff. We work with local bodies of ministries, and then try and work our way up, if you like, to the national level, building kind of relations on the way, and then we can introduce smaller projects at a local level to demonstrate. Like my example with China was doing small-scale disaster risk reduction in schools can then be replicated, scaled up on a later date. But I should qualify from China that after the 2008 Sichuan earthquake, every school in the Sichuan province was kind of knocked down, started again, and rebuilt in order to withstand a Richter scale 9, I think, earthquake, which is incredible. And that it just happened because it was the Chinese government, and that's what they do. And it's incredible because now they're all brand spanking new schools, and they're rock solid. And that's that, but that's a really unique kind of political context. So then you've got uber political will, if you like, on that stage, and then you've got kind of somewhere else where you have to take a completely different approach to making friends and demonstrating value and kind of going that way, or going through the UN or however else you might like to try.
I wonder if, Andrew, if you've got any comment on that, perhaps, on the point of, you know, how you do it when everything's against you in terms of political will and capacity and resources and so on.
Well, that's what I would say in response to that is that, you know, given the range of different types of challenges which you find in responding to disaster events, and the fact that the hazards are highly variable and the risks are very variable, at least one thing is true, is that the processes you go through are likely to be very similar each time. It's a bit like, say, we see firemen in the UK standing in floodwater. If there's a bomb explosion in the tube, it's the same people are involved each time. So I'm not really fully answering the question, but my reaction to it is that at least we can say that there are common types of procedures, and it's going to be the way you include people in the negotiation process, the development process. It's that starting point. If it's an education program, I'm sure this was the case in China, there's no good really starting unless people understand what you're trying to do. And you know, the same people need to often be included in a range of the different issues. So if it's an earthquake risk, then it may well be that if people are prepared for other types of risks, then they'll be better prepared for earthquakes as well. So it's about sort of grouping the approach, and I think that's probably the best we can do.
Okay. Another question out there. Gentleman there.
Yes, just staying on the same theme of safety in building construction, you've mentioned a lot about new build and Japan in particular as well. Also, given they had a sort of tabula rasa after the Second World War and the conventional bombardment, what about countries like Italy, where you've got, going back to Aquila and before that, Assisi, the earthquakes there, you've got significant centres of population that are still essentially Renaissance building there, where you've got 500 years old buildings sitting almost alongside modern build there. Is there any practical help you can give other than simply evacuate the whole of those areas? Because those medieval centres are simply never going to be able to withstand earthquakes when they happen, are they?
We'd like to take that on.
You're absolutely right. There is no solution. You can sometimes, at great cost, retrofit old buildings, old stone unreinforced masonry buildings you're talking about. In Italy, yes, you can save them and make them strong by building essentially frameworks inside them which you can't see and so on and so on. It's a question of whether you think it's worth it in the end. But it's a huge problem, certainly. I think if you find that the building is actually something like a hospital or a school, you really should not use it unless you reinforce it. It's the decision you make generally with these things is how much money do you want to spend and how important is it that the building survives. So something like a hospital which has to continue to survive after the work and function after the earthquake is worth taking a lot more trouble over than something, a block of flats, where as long as it doesn't actually fall down and kill people, you don't really care. The block of flats will only have a commercial life 50 years maximum, and then it'll get knocked down anyway and redeveloped. And if it happens to need destroying after 20 years because of an earthquake, that's bad luck, but that's essentially a commercial decision. What you care about is it doesn't squash people, and so you don't have to build it to quite such a high standard. So that's the decision you end up having to make. But it is tragic. These earthquake, rather small earthquakes in central Italy destroy the beautiful stone medieval villages, which everyone loves and likes going to watch and look at on holiday. It is a real problem. That's where people die. Yes. And when there is an earthquake, like the one in L'Aquila, they get replaced by modern concrete buildings, which don't look so nice, but they're a lot safer. And in places like Greece now, quite interestingly, in the places in Greece has many, many earthquakes of that sort of size in L'Aquila, really natural selection has taken over. It's much more expensive and difficult and harder to find the people who can build traditional stone-built masonry buildings. It's much quicker to get your local builder to just throw up a concrete shell, which looks horrible, but is actually an awful lot safer. And all the old buildings have more or less disappeared now in the places where there are a lot of earthquakes in Greece, and that has made the whole place a lot safer and uglier. So if you look in, if you go to Greece and you look at beautiful old buildings, it's probably because they're not earthquakes.
Anyone else want to comment on that before we go for another? No? Another question. There's a gentleman there in the green.
Is Haiti a better place today than it was 2 years ago in terms of risk reduction and quality of life and preparedness for future disasters?
Is that one you'd like to comment on? Maybe someone will help out halfway through.
In terms of what again? Risk reduction.
The resilience of the community to withstand future disasters.
Yes, I think absolutely. And this is the kind of problem that we face, is that you get all this incredible progress after some horrendous disaster somewhere, like the Sichuan earthquake, like the Haiti earthquake, like floods in Pakistan. You continually get people going, yep, disaster risk reduction, great, after an enormous disaster. So now we've got... I've recently moved to Save the Children, so I know that the plan and Save the Children both have a lot of really active child participation, community-based disaster risk reduction work across Haiti. So it's incredible the amount of knowledge and awareness that's going out now through our education and emergencies programs and through our ongoing development work across Haiti, particularly in Port-au-Prince and Jacmel and other badly affected areas. There was one other thing. No, I'll come back to it. Does anybody else want to add?
Just add. I think we've been working with the London crisis camps, and these are in cities across the world. And the crisis camps are groups of bloggers, they're people who use IT, and they just sit down, they set up for a weekend, and they say, right, there's a crisis going on, we need to do something. And in the Haiti crisis, they were translating tweets from French to English and to various different languages and actually helping out like that. But I think Haiti actually galvanised in the UK this idea of these crisis camps, because wherever people are, there's actually something that they can do. And it's a good example of where people using social media. Another good example is a power station went down in Haiti, and a computer company, I won't name at the moment, but they were going to charge a lot of money.
Oh, go on, for the Haitian
government to write the code. This was from an interview, so better not.
Okay.
Name the source to actually say, right, if you want this to replace the software, a charge of this much. And someone from the crisis camp actually came up with a solution and wrote the code, wrote the software, and the power station could go back up. So it's quite a good example of, you know, how aid can actually work. Mutual aid can actually work. So I think Haiti did galvanise those crisis camps. Yeah.
On the other hand, we did have the cholera epidemics in Haiti, which followed the disaster, which and long after the main event. So it's not all a wonderful story at all, and I'm sure everyone here would agree with that. But nonetheless, there's been a lot of grassroots type of work going on there of the right type that I'm aware of, but I haven't been there personally.
And then the cholera epidemics, there were rumours spreading it was because the UN, you know, was brought in by the UN and things like that, which didn't help.
It can't be proven, but it was alleged that a Nepalese UN sort of worker was in the area, and there's a lot of cholera in the west of Nepal.
I'm going to take one more question and then we'll wrap up. So, this gentleman here.
Hello, I'm from Chile, and I was in the earthquake 2010. And what I realized when I was in the earthquake were like many things that I could, and many things that you haven't talked about. For example, first, it was at 3:30 in the morning, I think, and I always thought that I was very educated and I knew perfectly well what to do in an earthquake, but at that time I was in a club and I really didn't know what to do. I felt like, okay, what should I do? I'm an engineer, what is the most intelligent thing to do? And I didn't know.
Could you just give us a sense of what it was like? You know, what was the experience like and how did it happen and how did you feel?
Yeah, well, the first thing that I did was to go out from the club, because first it was like a small earthquake, and suddenly I realized that this was going to be big, so I went out and everything was moving like really hard. So what I did was to go to a light
lamp
post, so just to see like where that would fall to go to our side. It was very like, and afterwards I went home and all like many people were, well, you didn't have light and you couldn't communicate with anyone. So like cell phones and everything went like you didn't have like to think that you could use social networks and everything was like impossible. And it was so bad that the central government wanted to communicate, for example, some towns that they will have this tsunami, and they couldn't because they didn't have any communication. So they thought that it would have been much better if they would have like their own kind of communications, like radio station with Morse code to be able to communicate and to tell them and to warn them that they will have an earthquake. And we had like this our problem that there was like a political, like the decisions were very like improvised and when they had to tell people that they were going to have an earthquake, they didn't know very well and they couldn't communicate, for example, to the center where they knew or they could make they could give the information that there was going to be a tsunami and so they couldn't decide anything till very late.
Where were you getting your information from? I mean, you described the cell phone networks were down. How long did it take for them to come up? And in the meantime, was it people with loud hailers in the street, or how was information being passed?
It depended on where you were. I was in Santiago, and Santiago was very quick, and everything was okay. But for example, my father was in the south, and we couldn't communicate with him like for 2 or 3 days. And the tsunami was like, for example, this was 3:30 in the morning. The tsunami came at 6 in the morning. So it was like you need fast communications. You couldn't communicate with the people who were studying like if there was going to be a tsunami or not, to tell afterwards people to go away from their houses. So many, like most people, died because of the tsunami, because they were like, in their houses. And there was another problem afterwards, that people like started thinking that they were not going to have any food, so they went to a supermarket like massively and steal everything, and then to some houses, and people like really started trying to defend their houses with guns and everything. And that's something that like it's very important to see before, so you can avoid those kind of things and to calm population. And that's something that is really it was the second earthquake that they call like that in Chile.
That's absolutely fascinating. I just want to put some of that to the panel. I mean, it's so difficult. You know, you can make all these preparations, and as the gentleman was saying, you know, actually in the event, a lot of things that you hope are going to work just don't work, and all sorts of things go wrong that you hadn't expected, perhaps.
We're thinking about that. We think that in emergencies, when media goes down, it's quite patchy. It might not all go down. It might be, might be okay in some areas and not in others. 7/7, the whole mobile network didn't go down. It was just patchy. But I'm sure, you know, your experience that for the whole country, it all did go down. But we're thinking about to what extent and what proportion of the population in the UK could you alert in an emergency? Because we now live in a multi-channel world, where people are watching TV, they're not even watching it live anymore. If digital radio went down, that's another problem as well. So, you know, unlike in the 70s and 80s, when we actually had a system of sirens which could alert everyone in the UK something was happening, we don't have that anymore. And it's actually a difficulty. In fact, in some ways, maybe we should go back to those more traditional ways of warning people, particularly, you know, if technology goes down, how do people actually get warned? So you can't depend on technology all the time. You're right, absolutely.
Anyone just want to close off?
Could I just ask a quick question? What was the kind of the extent of your preparedness education in school? Did you go to school in the area as well?
In Chile, like you know what to do if you're in your house or in school, but if you are like in a crowded place or you are in the streets, you definitely don't know what to do. It's like,
so it seems like there's kind of the schools have a kind of an institutional preparedness or whatever, but there's no kind of public preparedness.
I think that all schools like teach you what to do, but in those kind of situations.
That's incredible, actually.
it's hard to know what to do. In fact, I think it's probably a very good place to leave things, because that's an incredible story.
The other thing that I wanted to say, that I, my whole life I lived in the base of a volcano, and a very active one in South America. It's called Volcán Villarrica, and you have like eruptions like every 15 years more or less, and it's very beautiful because in some nights you can see like the red crater because of the lava, and there you have like ways where you have to go away if you have like an eruption and everything, and where you don't like where you can't build houses because you have like this like big risk of lava and things. And so, okay.
Well, thank you very much. I think I'll draw things to a close there. First of all, a huge round of applause for our panel. Thank you very much.